read us the opening passages from your latest novel, Braided Lives?
All right, this is chapter one, in which Jill forces herself on herself and begins. The day before yesterday was my birthday, and Josh boiled two lobsters in seawater and then baked a chocolate cake for the party later, so rich I wanted to eat it in tissue paper slices. As the sun shone warm for late March, the first seedlings, the cress, broke through the ground in the garden we had plowed and planted last week. All day I was glad, but curiously light and cut loose. In mid-afternoon I suddenly knew why. When my mother last read my poem that summer I left home for good, she told me I would die between the ages of 38 and 42. I had passed out of a zone of danger. "How could you have believed her?" Josh asked. I didn't. Some child closeted in me did. As I ran out of the house yesterday at 7 to drive to the airport with my head stuffed with the grit and sand of fatigue, something was nagging at me. All day in airports and bumpy planes, I hunched notebook in hand expecting a poem to issue from this curious itch, but it didn't. I was met by three graduate students and taken to my motel. A workshop followed with some good questions and a chance to make a few political points, a potluck supper with a local women's center, my reading. I strode to the microphone in my velvet gown patterned like a starry night and knocked over the water pitcher as I adjusted the microphone. Always preset too high. "We expected you to be taller," they said, as they always say. Then I went for their hearts. Passion out of accidental circumstance transcended is what they're buying. Afterward at the reception, the timidity, the weirdness, the undulating snake dances of ego before me kept me on edge. "Ah, come off it," I wanted to say. "It's just this person, me. All those years when I made a living at part-time secretarial work, people like you wouldn't even say hello to me. What's the fuss?" They think I am the book, solidified, but the books are the books. I'm just this round, cranky, tired woman who'd rather be home in bed with Josh by now telling the beads of our days and making the amber of that reality shine with the heat of our bodies. Too much self-regard has never struck me as dignified, trying to twist over my shoulder to view my own behind. And it's not a mirror I want, but a long view back. I feel as if I've come through rough terrain and across the wasteland around factories and down unmarked city streets without a map, and I both know and do not know where I have been. I want to explain to somebody, to me, to Josh, the hypothetical gentle reader, for though I've crossed the danger zone alive, still at 40 my life was wildly shaken by divorce, and if I find myself still myself now, that seems more of an accomplishment than it used to. I also find myself hard in love in a way I have to search far back in my life to match. It is not that whole busy swarming life then I feel compelled to march through leading you in a crowd of tourists into the bazaar, but those few years when I became the woman I have somehow, in all weathers and colors of luck, remained. I want to revisit that burned-over district where I learned to love in friendship and in passion and to work. Today, three planes end-to-end like rackety subway cars through the clouds have brought me home safe at last. I'm inclined to dawdle here where there's always wind fresh off the ocean and the sound of wind chimes and gulls crying and cats mewing on the wrong side of every door and one of our typewriters going. Whenever I get back, I wander in circles singing, "So glad to be back, so glad to be back." Are you so damn sure you'd like to meet your young self face to face? Mother of what I am now, sucker, poser, kid rawer than I'd like to admit, and yet survivor, with the wariness and strong stomach of the scavenger. I can summon up pity for a battered alley kitten, annoyance, patronizing approval, the desire to stick my fingers in and make me prettier, cleaner, braver, better. But what I really feel penetrating my ribs like a knife is stark terror, lest somehow entering that mind I'll be trapped back in that skinny 16-year-old body. I hardly got through the first time. My idea of hell is to be young again. Ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys, cats and dogs, have mercy on the candid, for they get what they crave, an education.
March Piercy is my guest. Was this book a journey for you also, a journey backwards to different decades? Did you find yourself looking at your own self as your character looked at her past?
Yeah, I think that that's always part of what happens when you go back, as in Vida, into the 60s, or as in Braided Lives into the 50s. You re-experience parts of your own life at the same time that you re-experience more collective lives and other people's experiences too.
Can you explain that impulse? I think we all have it, of wanting to look at how we were during another decade, 10 or 20 years ago, and connect ourselves with the person who we feel we were then.
A part of being able to have a sense of possibilities is a sense of yourself active in history. It's a sense of having ancestors, of having a past that leads to you from which you can meaningfully go into a future you want to create. You try to understand how you got where you are in order to get where you want to go.
Have you always been able to understand your past, to feel connected to the actions that you did several years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, everybody has done things on occasion which surprise them in retrospect, or which, you know, there's things you do at a certain point in your life you wouldn't do later, but that doesn't mean you don't understand them. I guess what I would say to you is that most novelists, I think, have fairly good sensory memories, and once you've grasped some sense details, you can get back into what happened, and you use empathy to enter other people in the same way. So that, you know, it's Proust's Madeleine. On all levels, you'd grasp some sensory detail lets you in.
Your main character in Braided Lives, in that opening passage that you read for us, says that her idea of hell is being young again. Do you share that?
Oh, I wouldn't care to go through it again. In addition, I think it was hard as it was to grow up in the 50s, I think it's just as hard now, maybe a little harder.
Why do you say that?
Oh, because it's so hard economically, and there's such a sense that you might not ever get to live out much of your natural lifespan.
Do you see in your own life, when you look back, really clear-cut markers that, like, chart for you the turning points when you started becoming political or started becoming a feminist?
No, not in those cases. I think that feminism, as it began to be available to me to take part in, as there was anybody else interested in it, I was immediately interested in it. And I think I grew up with some sense of political need and hunger. I needed a political dimension to make sense out of the world I saw growing up in working-class Detroit. I needed a political dimension for anything to make sense. So I started reading politically, I think, fairly early as I started reading anything, you know, anything seriously in high school. You know, certainly halfway through high school I was reading all the political books I could find, both political novels like Dos Passos, and I was reading Marx, and I was reading anarchists. And to the degree that feminists were visible, I was reading them, but they were almost invisible. I can remember my own resistance to the word because I didn't even know what it meant. And I was very interested in my Chicago years, which were in many ways the hardest of my life, when I was working part-time and trying to find how to be the kind of political writer I wanted to be with almost no role models available. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir, but not much available to look at in terms of what it meant to be a woman political writer. I became very interested in a number of things which have become the staples of feminist culture sense, but which were crazy to be interested in then. I can't tell you the time I spent. I had this secretarial job where I could get access to the stacks and of libraries, and I was always pursuing things like the history of the witches and the old goddess religions and so forth. But it was crazy to be interested in them then because there was no discourse available. You couldn't talk to anybody about them. You couldn't do anything with those curiosities and interests and hungers. Because until there is a social context, certain interests are crazy because there's no one with whom to communicate about them. When you can't communicate about something, you can't go anyplace with it.
Do you remember, did you have like a consciousness-raising group that you formed that you were a part of?
The first consciousness-raising group I was a part of was before that phrase was much used, and it was a women's group in SDS. The second one I was in was when I was starting consciousness-raising groups in, I think, like 69, 70. I think loosely connected with the Women's Center that was in downtown New York, but I was working in the Upper West Side mostly. And one of the groups I stayed in. Then when I moved to the Cape, I did that for quite a while. My friend Penny and I did groups, and we started them, and there was one we stayed in.
The one that was a women's group that was part of SDS, did the women eventually leave SDS, the women in that group?
Well, the SDS ceased to exist.
That's true, yeah.
Some people left, some people had it ceased to exist on them, and some people went off.
Was that a conflict for you then, staying within the New Left, which a lot of women felt was very male-defined and the power structure was very male?
It wasn't a conflict then. In early 69, when I was purged from something I was centrally involved in doing by a male I'd ceased to be involved, I got very angry. And everything came together. It was one of those things in which I was conflicted about whether I should be working with women or working with both men and women. Then I decided I was going to work with women. And for some years thereafter, I worked only with women.
You were purged?
Well, you know, just driven out, essentially. Anyhow, what I was trying to say is simply that when I got angry enough, I made that choice. I wasn't purged from SDS. I could have gone on working, you know, in any one number of ways, and there were a lot of people who wanted me to work on various projects. But I wanted to work with women and women alone then for a while, and I did that for quite a while.
When you write novels about political activism in the 60s, or people who are developing political consciousness in the 60s, are there riddles that remain for you that you try to solve through your characters?
Well, if you know, you're always exploring all kinds of things when you set out in a book. I remember one of the things that interested me in Vita was the idea of two sisters, one of whom becomes a feminist and one of whom remains in the regular left. And I tried to think, now, what different kinds of consciousness would produce that? What different situations? And that's one of the little sparks I started with.
Did you take sides in that?
No, because you can't, of course. I mean, to me, the political center of the book is Natalie. But to me, the interesting exploration was Vita, the one who isn't the feminist all the way along. Because it's less interesting to explore what you know than what you don't know.
So how do you find out what you don't know for that character?
You create the character, and when the character's real enough, you know then how that character makes choices, their values, how they see things. You're in them.
Did you find yourself wanting to seek out and talk to a lot of women who were politically radical but were not?
Well, I was in SDS. So
you knew enough already? You knew enough women already who fit that description?
No, I know what it's like to be political.
Does being a writer and being political, or being an activist and being a writer, ever clash? Since I think of the writer as the person who's kind of alone in a room and a typewriter, and an activist as someone who's always in the center of action.
A lot of political work is always done alone, and political work is not only organizing face-to-face. Cultural work is very important, and in a time in which most people have a very low level of consciousness about what is really hurting them and who's causing it to happen, cultural work is extremely important. All kinds of political work are, and they all complement each other. I think that in the 60s, I experienced very little support for being a writer. I was a good organizer, and there was a lot of pressure on me to do more and more of that and less of my writing. And the way I wrote Dance the Eagle Sleep was by getting up earlier in the morning than anybody else so that I'd have some time before everybody else got up, in which I could write without being impinged on. But the women's movement has always had a strong sense of the importance of culture, a strong sense of the importance of creating the arts and how the arts function for us in liberating imagination, in that if we cannot imagine living our lives differently than our mothers did, we cannot do other than live our mothers' lives. If we cannot imagine worlds we want to create, we can't work toward creating them. And we also very much need to find in art our own faces, our own, what we most hope for, what we fear, what we desire, that kind of dignity that the arts give us in our ordinary pains and pleasures.
March Piercy is my guest. You talk about finding your own face through art or through literature. And I know for a lot of women, they felt that the novels they were reading weren't really about them the way they knew themselves. And you were really amongst the first women writers to try to develop a novel, to develop a poetic form that was really from a woman's point of view and with a explicitly or implicitly feminist perspective in it.
That's a little ahistorical. Remember the Bronte sisters. Remember Jane Austen. Especially the Bronte sisters, because in a way they were dealing with the necessity of making a living too. What I think a lot of what I've brought into the novel recently has been working class women's experience, as opposed to simply women who at least are the daughters or wives of the middle class, because there's very few women who have a middle class existence in their own. Basically, middle class women are women who mostly are living with somebody who makes a middle class income. Some women make middle class incomes, but not very many.
So why was it important to you to write about working class women?
Because that's what most women are. And that's what I came from. That's how I spent most of my life.
I guess, do you feel you have to really be a part of the community of the kind of person who you're writing about in order to write about them well? That you have to have experienced that kind of life yourself in order to really understand it as a writer?
I think that empathy is tremendously important. I think that the desire to enter somebody else's experience with respect is often quite sufficient to do so. But there has to be a desire, empathy, and respect. Very frequently, when working class life is written about, it's written about in a way that is very unreal. It comes from other literary prototypes. It's all made up. Or comes, you know, the texture of the life is done in tremendous violence too.
Well, I think frequently in working class families, being an artist or a writer is a profession that makes the family pretty nervous. Because if you're a professional, like a lawyer or a doctor or a business executive, you have your salary coming in or an assured income. You have a dignified place in the community.
I don't come from a family in which people were doctors or lawyers or business executives.
Right, but it's something to aspire to.
Why?
Oh, I just...
No, in the family I grew up in, you didn't aspire to things like that. It wasn't considered... if pressure was put on me, it's more like get a regular job, get a secretarial job.
Yeah.
Bring in a salary. No, that's a different class you're talking about. There was no pressure at all put on me to do that kind of thing. It would have been very strange. It would have caused more estrangement.
But did it make the family nervous that you wanted to be a writer, which...
I think it was very unreal to them. I think it's still very unreal to my father and my mother. I think it was less unreal to... I think my mother liked to read a lot, so it was more real to her. In some way, she understood how you would write a book better than she would understand how you would run a computer or something.
Do you think they ever see themselves in your fiction, parents and characters?
My mother, fortunately, was still alive when I wrote Crescent Moon Like a Canoe, so I was able to give it to her. Though I gave it to her with trepidation, I was able to give it to her.
The thing that struck me as being really hard about poetry and fiction at times is if you're writing something based on people who are in your family or who you were close to and you're going to want them to read the book, you've maybe said things about them through characters that you wouldn't really want them to know you felt, that you wouldn't really feel comfortable telling them. Do you know what I mean?
I think it probably depends on the degree of intimacy or communication. And also, I rarely work from individuals. Most of the characters I create are such composites of so many characters that I think it will be hard for any one person to identify themselves in them.
Marge Piercy is my guest, and she's a poet and novelist, and I'd like to ask you to read a couple of your poems for us. And her new collection is called Circles on the Water, and it features selected poems from several of her earlier volumes of poetry.
This is called The Thrifty Lover. At the last moment you decided to take the bus rather than the plane, to squander those hours staring at your reflection on a dark pane. Then all night you rummaged my flesh for somebody else. You pinched and kneaded, testing for ripeness, rot, suspicious and about to reject me or knock down the price. You lectured me like a classroom on your reading of the week, used homilies, reconditioned anecdotes, jokes with rebuilt transmissions. All the time your eyes veered. What's wrong? I would ask. Nothing, you'd answer, eyes full of nothing. He goes through women quickly, a friend said, and now I see how you pass through, in a sealed train, leaving a hole like a tunnel.
There's another poem I'd like to ask you to read. The one that you just read is from 1969, I believe?
No, that's about 72, I'd say. This is Rainy Fourth, which is probably about a year and a half, 2 years old, this poem. Whenever the last Rainy Fourth was. I'm someone who boots myself from bed when the alarm cracks my sleep, spineless as raw egg on the tilted slab of day. I ooze toward breakfast to be born. I stagger to my desk on crutches of strong coffee. How sensuous then are the mornings we do not rise. This morning we curl embracing while rain crawls over the roof like a thousand scuttling fiddler crabs. Set off a 21 tea kettle salute for a rainy fourth with the parade and races canceled. Our picnic chilling disconsolate in 5 refrigerators. A sneaky hooray for the uneven gallop of the drops, for the steady splash of the drainpipe, for the rushing of the leaves in green whooshing wet billows, for the teeming wind that blows the house before it in full sail. We are at sea together in the woods, the air chill enough for the quilt, warm and sweet as cocoa and coconut, we make love in the morning when there's never time. Now time reigns over us, liquid and vast. We talk facing elastic parentheses. We dawdle in green mazes of conversing, seeking no way out but only farther into the undulating hedges. Gray statues of nymphs, satyrs and learned old women, broken busts, pass a fountain and tombstone in the boxwood of our curious minds that like pole beans on the fence expand perceptibly in the long rain.
Thanks for reading those. Marge Piercy is my guest, poet and novelist. When do you know that an experience that you had is going to be the subject matter of a poem?
Well, there's necessarily experience I had. There's no particular difference when you're working up experience, whether it's yours or other people's. If it's alive, it's alive. It has a kind of radiance. It doesn't much matter whose it was.
Of course, people always assume, I think, that poetry especially is very personal and very autobiographical. Does that assumption ever bother you or make for inconveniences?
I think that sometimes when reviewers try to extract some narrative out of a book where you very carefully placed poems in a particular order that has nothing to do with any naive, you know, circumstances or order in which anything happened, it can be very funny. And sometimes they will make all kinds of autobiographical assumptions. They'll take poems. You may have placed poems together that came from 3 or 4 different relationships if they were yours at all. And they will assume that this is what happened to you. And it gets very funny. There's a poem I remember called She Leaves in to be of use. And it was She Leaves. and I saw a review of it in which the book was all interpreted in terms of how I was having to leave this relation, some marriage. And I was writing the poem because it was about a certain time in the women's movement when a lot of women were leaving relationships. And I wasn't one of them, but I was interested in the experience, and it was very easy to empathize. There were several women in my consciousness-raising group who'd gone through, were going through that. But the assumption that all experiences that you write about is very funny. People make the same assumption about novels.
Mm-hmm.
And are sometimes very angry if a novel they've attached to, they've decided is autobiographical, isn't.
So what do you do?
What can you do? You try to explain what writing a novel is. The truth of fiction is a truth which is extracted from the chaos of experience. It's the place where you get to follow out the patterns, the large patterns and the small patterns, what people really turn out like, what things come into place over time. If you make one choice or another choice, how does it all work out? The simple chaos of any particular life, it's very hard to see those patterns in. You see them through many people's lives and you extract it.
Are love poems any more sensitive to write or to read than any other kind of poem is?
I don't know. I wouldn't really say so. I don't make that distinction between the political and the personal. To me, a love poem is personal. Write-to-life poem is personal. The poem about going out and digging manure into the garden is personal. The poem about canning is personal. The poem about my cats are love poems, too. The poems to my garden are love poems. Political poems are love poems. They're just different kinds of love. You mean, is it sexual love specifically harder to write about?
Mm-hmm.
There's one poem about orgasm, which was hard, which I probably never do, never perform much, simply because that's a sensitive subject. You get up and you ask why sometimes I say stop. That's just a little hard probably to do in public. But most of the love poems, no. I don't do a whole lot of them in any one reading. Partly because I think it turns off the audience. If you do a whole lot of love poems, people start thinking about their lovers. Why did he leave me? Oh, why did she leave me? Oh, why? Oh, am I going to see her tonight? Oh, what's going to happen? Oh, da 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 da. And they go off, and you've lost them because you've pressed certain buttons and they're gone. So I never do a whole lot of love poems, especially not in a row, just because it does press people's little fantasy buttons or memory buttons or something, and they're gone.
There's a pop song, I think from the 1930s, with a lyric, I think, by Ira Gershwin that's called What Can You Say in a Love Song That's Never Been Said Before? And it's sung in the point of view of a man who wants to sing a beautiful love song to his girlfriend but can't think of what else to say that won't sound cliched. And I've always wondered if you actually might go through that as a poet, since throughout the history of poetry, people have been writing love poems, and is it ever frustrating? What can you say that's never been said before?
No, because it's always new. Making it new is a problem, whether you're writing about a daffodil, or death, or love, or war, or pain, or hunger, or whatever you're writing about. People have experienced all of these things again and again and again, and the experience doesn't wear out.
Your new anthology, Circles on the Water, is a collection of poems from previous volumes. So in order to put it together, I'm sure you had to read through your entire volume of published work and order it and make decisions about what to include and what not to include in the anthology. Did you start seeing patterns either in your life or in your work that you hadn't seen quite like that before?
Oh, guess not. I think a fairly clear idea a lot of the time what I'm doing or notice things. I pay attention to things I'm doing because I read the poems. The poems, I'm more in contact with in my older novels because I'm saying them all the time. I might get up today, I have two readings, and I might well be getting up and saying poems I wrote, 18 years ago and some I wrote last week. And I have to, embody them, get into them, and say them from the inside. I thought a lot about the things I've done and not done, and that was interesting. At the same time, I was very shortly after I was putting the selected poems together, I was writing a book of essays, Particolored Blocks for a Quilt. I was putting together reviews I've written over the years. This is for the University of Michigan Poets on Poetry series. And my volume, which I think is the 8th or 9th, is called Particolored Blocks for a Quilt. And it was supposed to bring together things you'd written, you know, all fugitive pieces about poetry. But what I ended up doing was writing about a third of it for the book, because I realized I'd never written about a lot of things that I wanted to say. So I actually ended up writing, 7 or 8 new essays for it.
What were the subjects of those essays?
Well, it's mostly about poetry, so most of it was. Some of it, you know, about things about how Inviting the Muse was the first one I wrote, I think, and that's about how you get started, you know, on poems. And there was several pieces about revision and pieces about giving readings and pieces about how people respond to you. And then at the end, Ira Wooden, I did an interview to sort of clean up the stuff that I felt hadn't gotten in there, or he felt hadn't gotten in there, and so forth. So we did that at the end. That was the afterword. And in the middle was a whole lot of other pieces I'd written over the years and a lot of reviews, essays about Margaret Atwood and Audre Lorde and Joanna Russ and Adrienne Rich and so forth.
How did you develop your reading voice for poems?
Oh, I started out so terrified and so frightened that I had to learn, so I learned. Like you learn anything. Like you learn to sing, you can learn to read.
Do you hear the poems the way you want them read as you write them?
Oh, you always hear poems, yeah. My poetry is very oral, and I'm very conscious of sound. I have a certain, you know, amount of contempt for poems that fall apart when you read them. I believe that that's a real test of a poem in a lot of ways, is whether poems to me are arrangements of sounds and silences, and whether that arrangement of sounds and silences really holds together.
When you read other people's poetry, do you read it out loud too?
Yeah, often. I hear it, whether I'm reading it actually aloud or not, I hear it in my head. Yeah, I was reading Mary Oliver on the plane this morning and really enjoying her rhythms and sonorities.
Do you feel like a lot of people read poetry since... I don't know. I think that you're a pretty popular poet, but I think for most poets, it's difficult to find an audience outside of other poets.
I think that a lot of people love poetry, and a lot of people seem to respond to it. I think there's a lot of poetry that doesn't take enough chances. It doesn't have enough passion. It isn't. It's kind of ego dribblings or little. Oh, constructions like they learn to do in writers' workshops. Poems like other poems that remind you of other poems.
Uh-huh.
And I think that if you don't do more than that, of course you're not going to attract other people than people who are doing the same thing and want to see how somebody else is doing it, sort of like looking over the opposition in a lot of respects. I think that poets who do speak in ways that move people, who create objects that do move people, I think do reach out a lot. And I think that, especially with women writers, women poets, there is a large audience there that really wants poetry.
I wonder why that is. And I say that because there seem to be so few groups of people who you could say that about, that they really want poetry.
I don't know. I first saw an interesting relationship between poets and audiences in the 60s when I lived in New York and went to a lot of black readings. And I thought, there's a different kind of relationship. Because a standard mode of reading when I was going to poetry readings was often a certain male style of reading, where white male poets would read as if they had contempt for the audience and as if, you know, it was really... you know, a great embarrassment to them to be there at all, and they were a little bored by it, and they weren't going to show any emotion, and they were so cool and so bored and, you know, mumble, and, you know, it was sort of as if you were acting out of contempt for the audience. And that was a prevailing style when I was going to poetry readings when I was young. And And I thought, gee, how awful. And when I saw, Sonia Sanchez and Nick Giovanni and Donnell Lee and a lot of people in June Jordan reading to audience, I thought that's a totally different way to do it. They read with passion, with love for the audience, with respect for the audience, with excitement for the audience. You know, they're trying to put the poems across. They're trying to say those poems. They're taking chances in how they say the poems. They're really willing to get into it. They're willing to put it out. And I thought that's a much better way to do it.
It's really performance-oriented poetry.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you to read one of your poems. It's one you referred to before about abortion.
That's the one with the phrase that I am taking back, right to life. A woman is not a pear tree, thrusting her fruit in mindless fecundity into the world. Even pear trees bear heavily one year and rest and grow the next. An orchard gone wild drops few warm, rotting fruit in the grass, but the trees stretch high and wiry, gifting the birds 40 feet up among inch-long thorns, broken atavistically from the smooth wood. A woman is not a basket you place your buns in to keep them warm, not a brood hen you can slip duck eggs under, not a purse holding the coins of your descendants till you spend them in wars, not a bank where your genes gather interest and interesting mutations in the tainted rain. You plant corn and you harvest it to eat or sell. You put the lamb in the pasture to fatten and haul it in to butcher for chops. You slice the mountain in two for a road and gouge the high plains for coal, and the waters run muddy for miles and years. Fish die, but you do not call them yours unless you wish to eat them. Now you legislate mineral rights in a woman. You lay claim to her pastures for grazing, fields for growing babies like iceberg lettuce. You value children so dearly that none ever go hungry. None weep with no one to tend them when mothers work. None lack fresh fruit. None chew lead or cough to death. And your orphanages are empty. Every noon, the best restaurants serve poor children steaks. At this moment, at 9 o'clock, a partera is performing a tabletop abortion on an unwed mother in Texas who can't get Medicaid any longer. In 5 days, she will die of tetanus, and her little daughter will cry and be taken away. Next door, a husband and wife are sticking pins in the sun they did not want. They will explain for hours how wicked he is, how he wants discipline. We are all born of woman. In the rose of the womb we suckled our mother's blood, and every baby born has a right to love like a seedling to sun. Every baby born unloved, unwanted, is a bill that will come due in 20 years with interest, an anger that must find a target, a pain that will beget pain. A decade downstream, a child screams, a woman falls, a synagogue is torched, a firing squad is summoned, a button is pushed, and the world burns. I will choose what enters me, what becomes flesh of my flesh. Without choice, no politics, no ethics lives. I am not your cornfield, not your uranium mine, not your calf for fattening, not your cow for milking. You may not use me as your factory. Priests and legislators do not hold shares in my womb or my mind. This is my body. If I give it to you, I want it back. My life is a non-negotiable demand.
March Piercy reading a poem from her new collection called Circles on the Water. Did something happen that precipitated that poem, or was it...
a lot of things been going on. The woman who dies, of course, is Inez Garcia, who was the first woman who died when they made Medicaid abortions illegal. But, you know, the death of women, which is starting, which the London Disease Control Center reports on, and women having babies they don't want, and the rise in child abuse and all of those things, which I think go with it, especially in hard economic times.
The subject of your poems now range from subjects like abortion to what you're growing in the garden, since you're living in Cape Cod now. Do you find that your political readers gravitate to one thing and your neighbors gravitate to another in your work?
Oh, I think, yeah, there are people who like the poems about oak trees and snakes, and people who like the poems about the woman dying, you know, in the nursing home of neglect and so forth. But to me, it's all one vision. And I think in feminism, it is all one vision.
What's the connection there between the garden and politics?
How you get your food and what you eat and how you deal with your waste and so forth is a highly political subject. And if you don't feel connected to other living beings, you can make all kinds of decisions which kill them without understanding what you're doing. And if you don't feel connected, you make decisions that is going to affect the lives of children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and you don't care because you don't feel connected, except maybe to your own kid who you're going to get into a safe place or something, you know, the fallout shelter or something. You're able to make decisions which mean death to the web we're part of, because you don't feel a part of that web. You don't understand how connected you are.
What were some of your reasons for moving to Cape Cod?
My reasons for moving there were largely that I wanted to go on living, and I was told if I remained in New York City, I wouldn't, because I had developed a lung condition.
So
the air's good there.
It's changed your writing to be there?
Oh, tremendously, yeah.
By giving you different ways of looking at things and
yeah,
new subjects?
Yeah, I've become a peasant, basically. From a city dweller, I've become a peasant. I mean, we raise all our own vegetables, a lot of our own fruit. You know, this time of year, one of the big things is to get enough manure. I mean, yeah. I go into the city a lot. Oftentimes, I go back and forth a lot. It isn't like I'm never in the city, but yeah, I've learned a different way to live.
Would you read us one of your garden-type poems?
Garden-type poems. This is the attack of the squash people. This is a horror-type poem. And thus the people every year in the valley of humid July did sacrifice themselves to the long green phallic god and eat and eat and eat. They're coming, they're on us, the long striped gourds, the silky babies, the hairy adolescents, the lumpy vast adults like the trunks of green elephants. Recite 50 zucchini recipes. Zucchini tempura, cream soup, sauté with olive oil and cumin, tomatoes, onion, frittata, casserole of lamb, baked top by cheese, marinated, stuffed, stewed, driven through the heart like a steak. Get rid of old friends. They, too, have gardens and full trunks. Look for newcomers. Befriend them in the post office. Unload on them and run. Stop tourists in the street. Take truckloads to the city. Give to your Red Cross. Beg on the highway, please take my zucchini. I have a crippled mother at home with heartburn. Sneak out before dawn to drop them in other people's gardens, in baby buggies at church doors, shot smuggling zucchini into mailboxes, a federal offense. With a suave reptilian glitter, you bask among your raspy fronds, sudden and huge as alligators. You give and give too much, like summer days limp with heat, thunderstorms bursting their bags on our heads, as we salt and freeze and pickle for the too little to come.
Another poem by March Piercy is collected in her new book, Circles on the Water. In another poem that is, I guess, more about gardening than that one really is, you talk about how, about learning to live your life in a circle instead of in a straight line. And I was thinking about how that must really be when you're out in the country and you're actually gardening and the seasons become really important in a way that they're not when you live in the city.
Well, I think the lunar cycles started from that in that my husband oysters. He has a commercial oyster license, and that is very lunar also. And you notice all those things vastly more.
But I was wondering if that sense of...
When you live close to the life processes. Yeah, you notice everything. You notice little changes in the weather. You get very sensitive to it. He was talking about that the other day because he's lived there much less time than I have, and he notices the changes in himself.
When you think of things as a circle instead of a straight line, does your own sense of progress and your own sense of, like, goal orientation change too?
Well, the circles are the title of one of my books is The 12 Spoke Wheel Flashing, and that's the solar book. The moon is always female, is the lunar book of the books of poetry. It's in epicycles. Things don't go in circles. They go in circles rolling forward the way the year does. You don't come back to the same place, but you go round again before you get to a new place. I think that that politically it's very necessary to keep that in mind. Otherwise, Americans tend to be tremendously impatient. They want instant everything. You know, you go to three marches and nothing's changed, so you give up. I did that last year and it hasn't changed yet. I wrote my congressman and you know, still things are bad, so you can't do anything about it. There tends to be a lack of understanding of how you proceed and how long it takes to change things and how you have to be patient and avoid burnout and just live your life as you go, liking it, but also pushing things in the direction you want them to go, because otherwise they'll go in the direction you don't want them to go and you leave the world, dirtier and nastier than you found it. If you want to leave it nicer, simply cleaning it up as you go and trying to get it to a place where there's, in general, I always want to move in the direction of more freedom, more justice, more equality, a richer life for everybody. Then you think about how to get there and you think about it and you do it, you know, you figure it's going to be gradual. And yes, I do think political progress doesn't go in a straight line or massive great leaps. I think it goes like in epicycles, you know, round, the way a wheel turns, round and round and round and round, but slowly getting someplace.
I think that balance between patience and impatience is a difficult one to find, particularly if you're a political activist. You want to be impatient and use that to keep pushing, to push for change, to not sit by and wait for something to slowly happen, but to help push for it and to work for it, to direct things. But then there's the patience that you just referred to.
It's the patience of taking a long view. You want to take a very long view. Poets always have to take a very long view. We have to have a memory back to Paleolithic times. We have to see, where we come from. As we see ourselves now is our very recent developments, how we're living, and they don't accord very well in many ways with our nature, if we can understand it. We're not, in essence, a violent species. The best thing you can say about people is revealed in the fact that we talk so much, is that we're a species that has to communicate with each other.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us and to reading to us selections from your work. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.